2 years ago, Michael Chabon published a piece in GQ magazine about accompanying his 13-year-old clothing-obsessed son to Men's Fashion Week in Paris, and the article quickly went viral. That essay opens a new collection that explores the meaning of fatherhood from the point of view of a father of four kids who also happens to be the son of an aging father. Michael Chabon's many novels include The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Moonglow, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. His new book is called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces, and it's published by HarperCollins. And I'm so pleased it brings Michael Chabon to our show. Hi.
Hi, Arun. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So, a year before you published your first novel, this goes some years back, you got some unsolicited advice from a famous author, an unnamed author in your book. Tell us what he told you, his words of wisdom.
He basically boiled it all down to three words, which was his prescription for the best shot at having a successful literary career and writing novels that were going to endure and matter, and that was, don't have children.
Do not procreate.
Yes. Yeah. And he was pretty absolute about it. There was no wiggle room, it seemed, in his mind.
And you were about to get married.
Yeah,
right?
I was about to get married and also about to publish my first novel and, you know, hadn't really begun to seriously consider having children yet, so it kind of caught me off guard. I was not... It was not something I had ever stopped to think about that there would be some kind of equation by which the more children you had, the fewer books you would write. And in fact, he put it to me, this was not his formula. He was quoting some other writer. I believe it was Richard Yates. Yeah, and who supposedly had said, you lose a book for every kid. You lose a book for every child. And just to have it, you know, something like formulated so starkly when I had actually barely written one book myself, you know, so far, and had no children. I wasn't ready. I was caught off guard. And, you know, in some ways I didn't really take it that seriously until actually, one divorce and remarriage later, I began to have children. I had my first child when my wife and I had our first one in 1994. So I was underway at that point. And it was quickly, I finally understood what he had been talking about. Like, I didn't necessarily agree with what he had said, but I understood the underlying issue that there is this, you know, tension between getting one's work done as a writer and being, an involved, attentive, participatory, engaged parent. It's a lot easier for a man, certainly was then and still is to this day, than it is for women writers, who in a sense, for a very long time, didn't actually have a whole lot of choice in the matter.
Sure.
But it's, you know, I got it. I understood. Once I started to have kids, I was like, oh, okay.
This is
how
it
works. I see what he meant.
Right, and not just one kid. You actually, almost in an act of rebellion, you have many, four kids. I don't know if many is the right word for it, but
four is many. Four is many, definitely. Four is very many.
But yes. What's interesting is that you and he, this unnamed author, mm-hmm. are going through various writers who have chosen to have kids or not to have kids, mm-hmm. for the sake of their careers. Mm-hmm. And he goes through Jane Austen, the Brontes, George Eliot, Virginia Woolf, as well as many, I guess, very well-known male authors.
Right,
as well.
Samuel Beckett. And, yeah, he's hitting me with all these writers, and I'm just standing there, you know, I'm 23, 4 years old, and I'm desperately trying to come up with some good counterexamples, and you know, first one I think of that comes to mind is John Cheever.
Right.
You know, and I was reading his daughter Susan's memoir at the time, and like, that's not a good example. And then I thought, you know, Thomas Mann, and
it's not a good example for those who don't know, just to tell us why.
Well, I mean, John Cheever, his home life was very rocky and tempestuous, and his having read this memoir by his daughter, I definitely had the idea that maybe he wasn't necessarily the best at balancing work and child rearing.
Yeah,
let's put it that way.
Right.
I didn't have any good, I couldn't come up with any really good counterexamples then, and even today it can be tricky.
Yeah, and Thomas Mann, he
would lock
back.
Himself in his room, apparently, and you know, literally lock the door in the room that he worked in, and you know, the children would sort of bleat helplessly.
Scratching at the door.
Exactly.
Daddy,
in
please.
In fact, I was just reading another description of that happening with like a writer. It was a woman writer writing about her children sort of literally scratching at the door oh, and whimpering until finally they went away.
Oh my God.
You know, so it's, there's no question it is it's a challenge. You know, I guess the point of this essay that opens the book, the introduction, is not so much to, I don't come down on one side or the other. Like I'm not weighing in saying, you know, looking back, I realize
he was right.
And I'm not saying, no, I made the right choice by having children, you know, and this is a non-problem because children are more important than books. What I'm saying is either way, whether you choose to sacrifice your child rearing to your art, or whether you compromise your art by having children, in the end, it doesn't matter either way. The same thing is going to happen. You're going to die, right? And if you're thinking about posterity, you won't be around to enjoy it anyway. If I had listened to his advice and never had children, because I have not been, you know, like a perfect father. Like I've done a worse job as a father because I needed to devote myself to some degree to my work. I did compromise as a father to do my work, and I compromised. I made those compromises, but in the end, what difference does it make one way or the other? You know, ultimately, I guess I come down the side of, like, at the very least, my children, up till now at least, love me back, and my books don't, so.
And another thing you mention is that once you finished a book, it holds no mystery for you, which mm-hmm. I thought was interesting. And I think that is something certain childless authors or writers who have made the choice not to have kids might quibble with in terms of the choice between progeny and art.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see it as a choice that you have to make, or that if you do, whether you see it as a choice or not, or whether you make that choice or not, in the end, it all ends up in the same. We all end up in the same place. But I mean, I don't think, I would be very surprised to encounter a writer, a novelist who felt that a novel that she had completed and sent out into the world continued to hold mystery for her or for him. You know, I mean, it's not, once you're done with a book, you're done. I don't think you can be more done with anything in this world than you can be done with a book that you've moved on from. And what with your children, I mean, they're human beings, which means you'll never get to the bottom of them. You'll never get to the end of them. They're changing all the time. They, you know, they, even in that, when they're being consistently themselves, they're still surprising you in ways that you haven't understood. And I'm not saying this is a special feature of children. It's a part of being humans. And if you choose to share your life with more than one other human being, you're letting yourself in for a lot of mystery, you know, for the good and for the bad. And books just, you know, once you're, all the mystery in a book is, for me at least, and I can't imagine it's not this way for most writers, is very much used up by the time I get to the end of it.
I'm talking to Michael Chabon about his new book called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces, published by HarperCollins. Now, you write a bit about your own father, and you even close the book on an essay about your complicated relationship mm-hmm. with him. Has fatherhood changed your feelings toward him?
Oh, very much so. You know, my dad and I had, I would say, no more than the average amount of conflict when I was, you know, emerging into late adolescence, young manhood, you know, just without getting overly psychological about it or trying to diagnose it. Just inherently, there's going to be some level of conflict and some desire on the part of the son to step out from his father's shadow, or, you know, distinguish himself maybe through opposition to the father. I mean, that's just very normal and natural. And that definitely went on with my father and me. And then, you know, my parents divorced, my father moved away. You know, I had a lot of resentment and anger and, you know, that lasted well into my late 20s. I became a father at age 30 for the first time, and still very much the relationship felt to me, at least, very fraught in many ways. It was not all at once as soon as I had children, but maybe after I had 8 or 10 years of being a father under my belt, by the time my third kid came along, I started to realize at that point I had made so many mistakes myself. I had fallen short so many times of the mark that I set for myself as a father. I had, you know, advertised to myself and the world certain policies I was going to uphold and enforce that I had slacked off on, and, you know, had failed in my resolve to be forthright with my kids or be honest with my kids or to, you know, hold them accountable and for their actions in one way or another. I had, you know, I had failed in so many ways, and I could see the mistakes I was making and had made mounting up around me. And inevitably, I think that began to incline me to turn a more forgiving eye towards my own father and to realize, you know, here I am. Yeah, I'm a product of a different generation. I came of age in the 1970s at the high water mark of that second wave of feminism in America, you know, in a very experimental decade where boys could play with dolls and girls could become truck drivers and that was a sense of a lot of barriers and boundaries breaking down between gender roles and parental roles, and even though I came of age and with this desire to be a good father in some ways the way a woman is a good mother, I still was falling short of the mark. And in some of the very old-fashioned conventional ways that my own father had fallen short. And in spite of the fact that I was trying as hard as I could, I was doing the best that I could, and sometimes that wasn't good enough. And then I looked at my own father and realized, you know, he was doing the best that he could with different societal expectations, different cultural expectations, lower expectations, mm-hmm. more minimal expectations. Mm-hmm. But still, he was trying his best. He did the best he could. And so, yes, over time, I have gotten much more forgiving towards him. And I don't have any kind of anger or resentment or any of it. It's all been gone for a very long time now.
So there's a scene in one of your essays, the final essay in this book. You're sitting with your aging dad. Mm-hmm. He's just gone through this medical crisis. Mm-hmm. He's recovering. Mm-hmm. And you take a very urgent flight from, I guess, Oakland to Portland, right? Mm-hmm. And you find him in bed watching Metropolis, right? Fritz Lang's movie.
Right.
And you start thinking about, like, finally having that deep conversation that you never had with him. Mm-hmm. But then you just end up watching the movie. And I'm just wondering, do you think of this as a missed opportunity to have had that conversation?
I mean, we've actually had that conversation at other times. Okay. And since then, and in fact, when he read that essay, the title essay Pops, you know, it spurred a fairly short, somewhat awkward, but definitely heartfelt conversation. You know,
did he reach out to you, or did he start?
I sent him the essay, I emailed it to him, and then he read it and called me.
Okay.
And you know, he was touched by it, and you know, there's a passage in that piece where I talk about some of the disappointment and resentment that I had come into manhood with regard to him. And but it's just in passing in that essay. It's really just a sentence or two at most. And he kind of zoomed in on that and wanted to sort of talk about that and tell me to acknowledge and to tell me what he thought I had been talking about, because I didn't get explicit or mm-hmm. give any details. And I just, like, quickly just like, Dad, just do not worry about that. Like, that is not, they're gone. Like, those things don't matter anymore. There's no point in, you know, please understand that I've moved so far beyond any.
But did he believe you? Did he reassure
him? I hope so. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think so. You know, the important thing is about the conversation we missed that day when I went to visit him was not the big, deep conversation. It was the small trivial conversation about Fritz Lang and Metropolis and his marriage, Fritz Lang's marriage and so on, because he couldn't speak at that. He every time he tried to talk, he would start coughing, my father. So we just lay there on the bed watching Metropolis, and we really couldn't talk. And the conversation we didn't have was the conversation we would have had about movies and science fiction and Metropolis in particular and all that. And I had to have that conversation in my head lying there next to him. I did have that conversation with him in my head. I knew just what he would say. I knew just what I would say. And what I realized was that there's going to come a day, you know, I hope it's a while yet, but there's going to come a day when those are the only kind of conversations I get to have with my father. Like, I will never be able to have that routine everyday kind of conversation about movies or politics or books or baseball or whatever it is with him, except in my head.
And that's so much the problem, the challenge of having a fresh conversation with the family members. So often you imagine yourself going through a script, the script that you've been revisiting. Mm-hmm. And so it's so hard to take in words and think that they're actually new words.
Right. Or, I mean, you have to, I guess I sort of realized the value when I was deprived by just a sort of physical circumstance, and not by death, but just from a passing, you know, infection, essentially, when I was deprived of the ability to have that routine conversation with him, I realized the value of it to me. And that clued me in, like, well, there's a day that's gonna come where you are never gonna be able to have this routine conversation with him again. And now that you're realizing the value of it, maybe, like, going forward, realize the value of these routine conversations while they last. You know, and that's so much of, it's hard to stay in that mind frame. It's exhausting and maybe beyond the capacity of human beings, except for the most enlightened among us. But, you know, the idea of to sort of flip the telescope around, when you have sons, I have two sons, and when they're little, they'll hold your hand, always. They'll take your hand, they'll walk with you. And then an age comes when they won't hold your hand anymore, and it's not appropriate or whatever. They just stop holding your hand. And with my second son, because I had been through the experience with my older son, I knew this day was coming someday, maybe when they get to be about 7, 8 years old. And so every time my son took my hand after he was about 5 years old, I just tried to notice it and, like, appreciate it and think to myself, like, this could be the last time he ever holds my hand. So, you know, to have those moments of consciousness, I think that has been something that's taken me years of practice and sort of maybe acquiring a certain amount of wisdom. I'm 55 years old tomorrow, to be able to grasp.
So this son who ends up becoming a 13-year-old who is very much into fashion, you take him to Paris and you end up writing about it. Did he end up reading that?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I don't, when it comes to nonfiction, if I'm writing about one of my kids or my wife or my brother or whoever it might be, I always have them read the piece and make sure they're okay with it. And so in the case of Abe, when I finished that piece, I gave it to him and I said, look, you are in charge here. So, like, anything you don't like in this piece, anything you're uncomfortable with me saying, anything you wish I would say differently or would leave out, just tell me and it's gone. Like, you have total final cut on this. And he read it and he really liked it. And then he had this list of, like, all these grievous factual errors I had made about various, like, no, it wasn't Maison Margiela, it was, you know, Yoji Yamamoto, and it was, no, that didn't happen at the Rick Owen show, that happened at the Walter Van Beerendonk show, or I wasn't wearing those shoes, I was wearing these shoes. It was all just fact-checking, like, you know, New Yorker magazine level fact-checking.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So that was it, and I made those changes.
Wow, and so now he's a couple years older than when you first wrote about him. He's still obsessed with fashion?
Yeah, I mean, it's just part of his, it's part of the way he looks at the world. It's so incorporated, I think, into his personality and his viewpoint that it's almost, obsession's not quite even the right word. It's a more of a habit, in a sense, than an obsession.
I've been speaking to Michael Chabon about his new book called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces. Thank you, Michael, for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Arun. Thank you.
And happy birthday.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.